6, Jim, paper 40.
Paper 40, I think a related issue. Andy, is that you?
Thanks, Jim. Before I get into paper 40, which talks about the practical expedient for measuring progress towards complete satisfaction of a performance obligation and the related disclosure requirements, the staff would like to clarify that if you have a series and it qualifies for the practical expedient, you may apply the practical expedient guidance. So we've received some questions subsequent to the issuance of these papers, whether or not you may apply the expedient if you have a series. So we'd just like to clarify that before I begin the overview of the two issues in this paper. The paper includes two issues around the practical expedient for measuring progress towards complete satisfaction of a performance obligation and the related disclosure requirement. And issue one really gets into some questions that stakeholders have raised related to the expedient for measuring progress. And unfortunately, we have a significant write-up on what is really only one sentence in the standard. Paragraph 606.10.55.18, or B16, explains that the practical expedient may be applied, and I'll just briefly summarize, when an entity has a right to consideration from a customer in an amount that corresponds directly with the value to the customer of the entity's performance completed to date. For example, a service contract in which an entity bills a fixed amount for each hour of service provided. The entity may recognize revenue in an amount in which the entity has a right to invoice. And so we've received questions that I would divide into two camps. One type of question, and this is covered in paragraph 12 of the paper, is when you're referring to this expedient as kind of price times quantity expedient, when you're billing an amount, a price for a quantity that you're transferring to the customer, does that price need to be fixed? And so we've provided two examples in which we believe that the price does not need to be the same price for the entire duration of the contract. Example A illustrates that it's the same performance obligation and the price changes, and that's okay. And in example B, we have a number of different activities for which the price changes over the duration of the arrangement. And even though there is, I believe, amounts that are fixed that are, I guess, minimum amounts, they're not substantive. If the entity is billing amounts that correspond with the value that the customer receives for performance completed to date, that's okay. So there's been a lot of, I guess, what the staff would describe as strict interpretations on when to apply the practical expedient, and we wanted to demonstrate that there may be some judgment that can be applied when thinking about that. That's, I guess, one bucket of questions. The second bucket of questions relates to a basis of conclusions paragraph in BC 163. BC 163 is not related to the practical expedient. It's related to the context of measuring progress towards complete satisfaction of performance obligation with a focus on proportion of outputs delivered relative to the total outputs and the total performance obligation, not the practical expedient. So that's really the crux of issue one. Issue two is related to the practical expedient for disclosure requirements, and the purpose of this issue is more educational, just to demonstrate, think about whether you qualify for the practical expedient in issue one. If you do not, while constrained variable consideration is not included in total transaction price, there are required qualitative disclosures for the constrained variable consideration. I think one other point that the staff would like to observe related to a point that's not in the issue, paper 40, if you are applying the series guidance and you don't qualify for the practical expedient, you may not be coming up with total transaction price. And so when you think about the disclosure, you may be required to do work for disclosure purposes that you aren't doing to recognize revenue. So with that, I'll turn it over to the TRG for discussion.
I read the paper and I was a little confused on example one, or example A, and maybe you can help me out with it. I guess the facts are is, you have a commodity and there's a forward price curve. The contract is 6 years, and if I plotted out those contractual prices, that does not, that's not a curve, that's steps. So I'm wondering if it's just described that way for, to be simplified, or whether the staff actually thinks that this approximates a curve. Like, it, for example, if the contract said, you know, we got a curve and the price will reset contractually every month, if I plotted those out, that would kind of look like a curve. This does not look like a curve.
Curve is probably not the best word choice. I think it contemplates the curve, but it's not. It doesn't directly correspond to the curve.
So you apply judgment, I guess. I mean, to me, it's a facts and circumstances. Like, if you have a curve, then, you know, show some prices that look like a, kind of look like a curve.
That's right. I think based on stakeholder group that we spoke to in this space, directionally, it wasn't corresponding to the plots on the curve. It was more it's close to the curve.
That and there may not be a curve.
Correct.
There might be many different measures of what can happen over, you know, 1 year, 3 years, 6 years, whatever it is. In our view, if the pricing varies and you can explain why that pricing varies, then you may be able to apply the practical expedient. And in this industry, what was explained to us is the pricing will often vary based on a third-party market measure, even though it's not exact. And it seems to us that would be good evidence that there is a relationship between the amount to which you're billing each period and the value to the customer.
This paper is very helpful. This has been a part of the standard that I have struggled with myself as the application of 5518, and in particular, reconciling that basis for conclusions paragraph. The analysis is very helpful because it's interesting. We've got in paragraphs 5517 and 5518, we have the same words being used in those two paragraphs, meaning references to value to the customer. But I think it's helpful to hear that this is an instance when having the same words, even in very close proximity, don't mean the same thing. It's kind of an interesting contrast when you think about the exposure drafts the FASB has recently had and the IUSB is about to publish, where we have different words and the boards are saying, well, no, the different words ought to mean the same thing. Here we're saying we have same words, but they ought to mean different things. So I do think that it's very helpful because the basis for conclusions or the analysis that you've put in here points out just a very subtle nuance that I'm not sure that anyone would have picked up on absent the analysis here. So I certainly hope that as much of that discussion gets captured in the minutes going forward, because I think that's a very important point.
Kez.
Yes, I certainly appreciate staff paper. I think it's very helpful to understand. It's not necessarily the fixed price, and it, to some extent, in the, I think the judgment is necessary, but for the price change or the due to the market change or situation change, that qualified that practical experience. I think this is very helpful guidance for the staff paper. The only concern I had is that the staff mentioned that if this is qualified, but doesn't meet the needs to work on the disclosure. Well, it doesn't. Practical experience is doesn't meet. It needs work on the disclosure. That may need additional work, as you mentioned. So I was not having good enough cases yet, but there might be some request for the stakeholders that might additional exception of the disclosure might be asked. So I just want to work on that further going forward.
Greg?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Consistent with Allison's comments, I think we look at the staff paper as really helpful in reconciling some of the difficulty we were having trying to look at the paragraph and the basis of conclusions, and when trying to apply the practical expedient and looking at how to sort of that statement about standalone prices with respect to, you know, determining value transferred to the customer at a point in time. So I think the path that the staff went through to try to point out the distinctions and the intent of 163 versus the practical expedient is very helpful, because, I mean, frankly, today, as I suspect many of you know, most of the IT outsourcing industry, a very high percentage of revenue is booked as billed for many of the reasons that we spoke about in the previous paper and then also articulated in this paper. And, you know, today, of course, to Jim Schnorr's point earlier, I mean, it's not a free-for-all. It's a process that we go through to ensure that the prices that are billed and recorded as revenue each month are benchmarked to market or standalone selling price, and that there's an analysis that is done to ensure. So I think overall, if the industry can now look forward to using the practical expedient under the right facts and circumstances, the paper is very helpful, and we would agree with the views.
Yeah, I think we're in agreement too with what everyone said. I had one question that I just wanted to run by, and it's something that came up is in applying the practical expedient. I think this is sort of indicating you can apply it, you know, to reasonable situations like this. There's been some that have said that if you have an upfront payment and then the pricing is reflective of whatever it is going forward, you get a different answer. Is that, I wouldn't think that would be the case, but it would seem like in a long, like say 20-year, you know, we've had some clients that they have 20-year supply agreements, it's all going to be at market, but there's an upfront payment of say, you know, several million dollars to enter into it to you know, lock in the supply. I think you would still get to the same answer here, that you could do it as billed, but.
What is the upfront? I guess the staff would probably ask what the upfront payment relates to. Is it a separate performance obligation? And then
it's not.
So how would you think about the language in BC 167, particularly the language in parentheses that says, I guess I'll read the whole thing. You don't have it in front of you. The amount of consideration that the entity has a right to invoice corresponds directly with the value to the customer of each incremental good or service that the entity transfers to the customer. That is the entity's performance completed to date. So in that particular fact pattern, if you have a payment and you haven't, doesn't represent performance completed to date, I guess, how would you think about that?
Sometimes you just get upfront payments and entering into supply. It's sort of like you're going to be there for me for the next 20 years. And in order to lock in that capacity or whatever it is, you'll get an upfront payment. Greg, I don't know whether you're in industry, whether there's upfront payments sometimes in those arrangements. I guess
the staff would evaluate, has there been, does that relate to performance completed to date to prior performances, or is it a prepayment for future performance?
It's probably a prepayment.
Think of it as
a prepayment.
Right.
Think of it as a prepayment, but spread that.
And then you would apply this to, from applying this if you're.
Well, I guess that's what I personally would struggle with, how it reflects performance completed to date if it's a prepayment.
Well, I wouldn't recognize the upfront payment,
but I guess
you bill for the services that you're getting.
Well, how would you separate that, though? If you have a prepayment and then you have other payments subsequent to that, I guess, do all of the payments represent performance completed today? Because I think most likely you'd have the prepayment and that may cover the life of the arrangement.
I think you're worried about a situation where
it's a reasonable.
It's a reasonable. It's a common thing to get an upfront payment and then bill.
I join a club and then I pay every time I golf.
Yeah, I'm aware of that one.
Yeah.
So. And now all you're saying is there, because you're worried about if we don't do what you want, then
no one will qualify.
Right.
I just want to make sure it's broad. I mean, the application is 55 18.
Well, yeah, I think about paper 39. Seems like it may be a series. I don't know. I mean, that's honestly, there's a difference in the examples in the two papers. If you look at the IT outsourcing,
why in the first paper can you not use 55-18?
Correct.
Because there's a prepayment.
Correct.
I
Just to chime in, I was also rather hoping that the existence of a prepayment didn't automatically kick you out of 5518. It sounds like perhaps that may not be correct.
I don't think we go as far as saying the mere existence. However, I think it would be challenging to qualify for the practical expedient.
When I say that, I mean the existence of a prepayment that does not relate to an upfront good or service. That is, it is literally just a prepayment. I would have done as Mark did and just said that clearly that prepayment I can't take all at once, but the payments I get for each increment of service, I thought I could. Maybe I got to do that by reference to paper 39 instead of 40.
Could I just add, at least in the IT space, there are many times there's an upfront charge for, you know, setup activities or what we call transformation activities. And in the context of an outsourcing client who's with you 3, 5, 7 years, the substantive part of that over the life of the arrangement, you might have a $20 million setup fee over a $200 million or $2 billion outsourcing arrangement or something to that extent. Sometimes they're paid up front. Sometimes the client doesn't want to pay for them up front, and they're billed, you know, each month as sort of a proportional part of the arrangement. So they kind of go both ways, just for clarification. But they're generally not material. I think that I sense you were going to make that point,
yeah,
Jim.
I'm not sure. I would think you'd look at the size of at a minimum, the size of the prepayment sort of relative to the total arrangement. I'd hate to, you know, as you point out, multi-year billion-dollar contract with, you know, $30 million prepayment, you know, basically to finance the cost of setup, saying somehow you're outside of the scope of practical accounting. Brett?
We agree.
Yeah, I agree with that as well in terms, and I think it also could be relevant in terms of a back-end rebate, let's say, as well, not just an upfront. So I think you'd probably look at the magnitude of it in relation to the amounts being billed, and, you know, is it sort of a proportion? Is it really a small bit in the whole in the scope of the whole arrangement? I wanted to come back to the BC 163 point, which I, you know, fundamentally agree with where the staff came out in terms of an outcome. I just wonder, and as we read that, the basis for inclusion, where it's sort of, in our minds, the ideal with gold standard would be that the amount billed represents value to the customer, and then if you had that would be the gold standard. So we kind of read that as the intention of that reference was really to suggest that wasn't a requirement, not that it was a gating issue, that if it did, that you couldn't use the expedient. So we just wonder, for the purpose of sort of, you know, documenting why we think that BC 163 isn't a problem, rather than trying to go down this path of saying, well, we use the same words, but they mean different things in these different applications, it wouldn't be better to say, well, really what the inference here was to suggest it's not a requirement, but certainly it wouldn't be a prohibition if you had it. So just offer that up as a suggestion.
Thank you. The first observation we have is that these illustrative examples might be helpful to add to the standard. They're particularly the electricity one, they're very relevant in the Canadian context. The second comment I have is that I will confess to being a wee bit confused in the interplay between these papers, because some of the conclusions that are reached seem to be, at least based on a view that a change in quantity can introduce variable consideration. That's not something that's contemplated in the standard. Quantity's never mentioned as one of the components of variable consideration. So I just wondered, after we saw the paper we're going to see at the next meeting, around whether changes in quantity are options to purchase additional goods and services, whether that would, we'd come back and reflect on 39 and 40 in that context?
I think that's a good point that there is an interrelated nature, and so making sure that after you've had a chance to see the analysis and the discussion there, that we do have a package that fits together. Ian, over to you.
Thank you, Jim. Any comments? Over 40. James.
Thanks, Ian. I think a lot of my comments have been stated in the US, and I won't repeat them, especially by Alison. And I found the paper very useful, especially example A, where the question has come up quite often. I have a concern, and maybe I can address that to the staff. In paragraph 16, and I agree with the conclusion of paragraph 16 of this paper, where you say the amount that will be billed is based on the units of power that will be transferred and a rate per unit of power that is priced by reference to some or other market indicator. Having gone through the paper, I all of a sudden wondered, are we now precluding fixed price contracts from the situation? So if a contract we had 6 years and the price was fixed for the entire 6 years, are we saying that it's not within all the practical expedient won't apply to that?
I don't think so.
No, I don't. That's not what we're saying. And I think if you look at paragraph 14 in the paper, which refers to example 42 in the standard, while that's only a two-year arrangement, the price is fixed. $25 an hour for a cleaning arrangement. So by no means, I think the purpose of the paper was mostly educational, to try to demonstrate to some stakeholders that prices actually may change, and we certainly weren't trying to suggest that just because a price is fixed, you wouldn't qualify for the practical expedient.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Andy. I think it was sort of saying it's got to reasonably approximate, and maybe it's short enough that fixed makes sense. That you sort of have to think about it. I guess if you had something where clearly value declined, but you were billing something fixed, that might be an indicator that billing doesn't reflect.
And I think we had concerns about that, including that notion, because we didn't want people to say, well, now all of a sudden you can't apply the practical expedient to fixed billing arrangements, because here we are trying to deal with prices that change.
But sort of the notion that it needs to reasonably approximate the.
I think it's just important to note that fixed notion in the standard is just, as Nick says in the paper, is just an illustration of a particular facts and circumstances. So I think very much agreed with what Jim just said.
Okay. Further comments? Brian?
I certainly agree that it's not necessary to have absolutely fixed prices in order to apply the practical expedient. I just emphasise the role for judgment in making the assessment. We had a bit of a discussion about example A and how closely this apparent step would track a curve. Similarly, example B, which talks about the benchmarking clause, it's a 10-year agreement. The fact that the agreement somewhere has the word benchmarking in it probably isn't enough. The question is, how does the clause work? How often does the benchmarking happen? What's the results of the benchmarking? How does that feed in? So certainly, I wouldn't want to be constrained by having a fixed price, but as an auditor, I'd want to do a bit of work to understand how closely these things are tracking value.
Okay, thank you. Tony?
I think maybe just to build off what Brian said, my sense is that what the paper is helpful, and what it does is give you a framework and says that you need to consider all of the relevant facts and circumstances in making the judgment around whether or not the amount you've got the right to bill reflects the value to the customer. And I think that's what this paper does, and it allows you to work within the framework of the standard to make sensible judgments. And so I think it's a helpful place to end up.
Good. More? Well, Jim, I think we're through. Back to you.
So I guess in summary, Andy, unlike Mary's paper that was a sonnet, I heard this one was generally useful, so you didn't quite hit that bar. But I think people seem to generally view the discussion in the paper as useful in understanding that you can have a pricing structure that varies as you would expect something to economically vary, and that doesn't preclude the use. Some comments about whether or not upfront and or back end adjustments to consideration preclude the use of the model. I think a sense that you have to use judgment to determine sort of the significance in the context of the contract, throwing in my own words, and whether that would then somehow indicate that billing doesn't reflect the value transferred to the customer, and an observation that we still need to consider the impact of an upcoming optional purchases paper, whether that has any implications on the model here and sort of how the whole package fits together. Anything else, Ian?
No, I think we're right, and then we can move on to the next paper unless you want to go and get your lunch boxes.